Welcome, everybody, to Penn. Glad y'all are here for our December presentation. There's a few things to tell you before we get started. How many of y'all, is this your first time to come to Penn? Welcome. Welcome. If you've been, it's been a long time. All right, how many of you found out about Penn by a personal invitation from somebody? By reading it in your school's newsletter? By getting a direct email from us? By looking at something on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram? Okay. Any other way that I'm forgetting? All right, we're trying to figure out how best to reach everybody, so thanks for your feedback. I also wanted to let you know about SEAC. I don't know if any of you have kids who have either a 504 or an IEP. If you're comfortable with that, would you raise your hand? SEAC is Special Education Advocacy Committee, I'm pretty sure, and they meet every second Thursday of the month from 9:30 to 11:30 at SARC, the old building that we used to meet at on Briarwood, 14188 East Briarwood, and they are meeting, they're actually meeting this week, Thursday, over there. They also are in charge of something called Golden Hearts Award. Has anybody heard of that or seen it in their school newsletter? Like somebody maybe from your school was given a Golden Hearts Award. There's maybe a dozen and a half people in the entire district, sometimes people outside of the district, who have shown extra compassion or extra just an extra step in working with kids who have special needs of any particular kind. And they're awarded this Golden Heart Award. So nominations come from anybody in the district. So if you're interested in that, I've got more information I can give to you at the end of the presentation. I wanted to make sure that y'all know that we've got fresh Starbucks coffee that's donated by the Bellevue Square Starbucks. If you ever go into them, make sure you tell them thank you for supporting Penn. Some clementines, and we've got information from our awesome sponsors at the back table. We thank Nicole from being here, from the Nectar Group, who's one of our platinum sponsors. And we also have books from our first speaker of the year, who was Jim Fay with Love and Logic, an amazing foundation for parenting, for working with your kids, as well as two books from our speaker today, Tricia Downing. So those are available for I'm sure, signing and personalizing if you would like to buy that for yourself or give as a gift for Christmas. January 11th will be the next time we gather for Penn, but that will be virtually. We will be meeting January 11th. If you have the pink little, can one of you hold up the pink little bookmark? Great. There's more in the back. If you would like to have all of those dates and topics, January 11th, we have a very special speaker who is coming to us from the East Coast, and we will be having a webinar virtual presentation that evening. She'll start at 7. We have somebody special from CCSD talking about the new health clinic that CCSD has initiated, and that will be at 6:30. So you can log on either at 6:30 or 7. You can go on to the website and get the okay. The link will be on the website, so you can access it that way. And feel free, like if you've got a sister who lives in Texas like I do, or somebody on the West Coast or somebody on the East Coast that you think would be interested in this topic of internet safety, send them the information, send them the link. We are happy to have anybody join us. And remember that if you know somebody who couldn't make it today or to any of the past or future presentations, that you can go onto the website and listen to the podcast, and you can hear Tricia again, or you can, you know, have your kids listen to Tricia, or you can, if you're driving up to the mountains, you can listen one more time on a podcast. So there's all kind of ways to enjoy our presentations. So right now, let me introduce you to Tricia. Imagine a moment so dramatic that it could define you for the rest of your days, that it could change what you do and how you do it, and call into question every dream you've ever dared to chase. What happens when you arrive back at square one? For Tricia Downing, a competitive athlete, life was about an active existence, freedom, and seeking out her next big adventure. That was until the day tragedy struck and everything changed. Arriving in unknown territory, Tricia found herself relearning simple tasks, reinventing her life, and redefining ABLE. In making her comeback to athletics and racing, Tricia took the lessons she learned through her injury and rehabilitation with her to the start line, realizing that life is just another sport, and the training we do makes the difference between simply being in the race or raising your arms across the finish line. Embark on a journey of self-discovery and explore the essence of the human spirit with our speaker as she shares how strength, courage, and perseverance turn I can't into I can when faced with seemingly overwhelming challenges. Please welcome Tricia Downing.
Have you ever thought about your personal motto? I had a friend who posed that question on her Facebook page one day. She asked, in five words or less, what is the motto by which you live your life every day? And when I read that, I had to think about it for a minute. And then suddenly a smile crossed my face, and I typed, always believe you can. Now, I think I came up with that so quickly because that's the way I was raised. My parents brought me up to believe that I could do anything, be anything, or make my life whatever I wanted if I was motivated, determined, and willing to work for it. And I think that it was also this sentiment that led me to believe when I took up bike racing, the sport of cycling, in my late 20s, that I could actually make it to the elite level of the sport. Now, that was a huge goal and a huge challenge, but I knew that I could do it because sports ran in my blood. I had been an athlete since I was 4 years old, and my mom took me to my very first swim lesson, which quickly turned into swim team and competition. And when I was in middle school, I was a gymnast, and I spent the better part of my time upside down. In high school and college, I was on my school diving team, so I was the kid, if I ever saw a diving board, I was immediately on it doing flips and twists. So it was no wonder that when I took up the sport of cycling, I was immediately obsessed. I spent all my time with my teammates racing and training. And when my girlfriends would want to go to the mall and buy all the latest fashions, I'd be sitting at home scouring the internet for the lightest components and super aero racing wheels. And on summer mornings, I would be up before the sun heading to my next race. I loved my bike. To me, it was a challenge. And I loved the hard work of seeing what my body was capable of mentally and physically. And so I had dreams and goals, and I truly believed in them. Well, in the summer of 2000, I had the good fortune of being a school teacher at the time, and so I had the summer off, and I thought, what better way to spend the summer than to pretend that I was already an elite cyclist? So I packed up my car with everything a girl could need for a summer away, which in a room of ladies. I know you guys know this is a lot of stuff. And I put my bike on top of my car, and all by myself, I drove out of Denver. I headed north to Wisconsin and did 2 weeks of racing there. And then I headed south to Indiana. And at the end of the summer, I ended up in a small town in Pennsylvania called Altoona. And while I was in Altoona, I was going to participate in a race called the Tour de Tuna. Now, the Tour de Tuna is much less prestigious than that small bike race you hear about in France every summer. But for me, it was no less exciting because every morning there were 150 women who would line up at that start line. And we were going to race for 6 days and cover 325 miles. So every morning when we lined up, there would be all of these different team jerseys, and all throughout the day, we were a sea of colors just rising and falling through the Pennsylvania hillsides. And to say it was an amazing experience would be an understatement. It was the biggest rush of my athletic career. So when I got back to Denver at the end of that summer, I started making all of the plans that I needed or that I felt that I needed to succeed as a bike racer. And I had learned so much from these women that I'd been racing with all summer, because there were many women in the field who actually were top international racers. And they were going to go on and compete in the Sydney Olympic Games in September of that year. So I had learned a lot while I was gone in it. And so I knew what I needed to do, and I set the plans in motion. So in September, my friend Matt came to visit me in Denver, and he was from Philadelphia, and so we spent the weekend at a wine festival in Grand Junction, and then on Sunday morning, we came back to Denver, and we were just hanging around at my house because trying to figure out what we were going to do for the rest of the day. He wasn't leaving until Monday morning, and so we were talking about it, and we decided we'd do some sightseeing, and because he was also a competitive cyclist, we decided to do it by bike. And so we went out to my garage, and we gathered up all of our cycling things. We had our Lycra cycling outfits on, and we got our gloves and our helmets and glasses and shoes and got on our bikes, and we rode out of my garage and down through the Cherry Creek Shopping District, which was right near where I lived, and jumped on the bike path headed to downtown Denver. And when we got downtown, we jumped off the path at REI and started heading west. And on this day, I decided that I wanted to take him to Lookout Mountain. So we headed toward Golden. And I had one very distinct reason for wanting to take him to Lookout. It was because I wanted to make him suffer. Because he wasn't used to training at the Colorado altitude like I was. And so this was going to be a day when I was really going to put the hurt on him. And so we get to Lookout Mountain, and of course we had a nice leisurely ride. We started heading up the mountain, and if you've never done the Pillar to Post ride, it's 4 miles straight up, digging deep. And so as we were riding up the mountain, everything below us became miniature. The trees, the homes, the cars. And I was beginning to feel like I was on top of the world. Because the only thing that I could see in front of me was possibility. And there was even a moment there when I actually felt invincible. So we're riding up the mountain, and we finally get to the top, and we parked our bikes in the parking lot of a little restaurant and bar that was up there. And Matt stayed with the bikes. I grabbed the water bottles, and I went into the bar, and I walked up to the bartender, and I asked him to refill our water. And as I was standing at the bar, I looked up, and above me there was a television screen, like there normally is at a bar. And at this time, they were actually broadcasting the Olympic Games, because the Sydney Olympics had started. They were a little bit late that year. They were in September. But as I was looking, they were actually showing the sport of cycling. And I know you guys have probably seen as many Olympic broadcasts as I have, and you know that usually they're stuck on the gymnastics and the swimming and the basketball and the track and field. So to see my sport, the sport of cycling, up on the television screen, I thought, oh my gosh, this is a sign from above that I'm going to reach my goal. And I got so excited. I literally grabbed the bottles off the bar and skipped out of the door and back to the bikes. And I told Matt about it. I said, you know, the Olympics are on TV and they're showing the bike racing. We have to stay and watch. And Matt had another idea. He said, you know, let's go back to your house. We'll take our showers. We'll park it on the couch. We'll be able to watch the Olympics all night long. So we got back on our bikes and started heading down the mountain. Now, Lookout is an amazing descent. You can be going over 20 miles an hour in some places. And in others, you have to brake and go below 10. Because around any one of those very technical hairpin turns, you could hit a patch of gravel and easily go down and hurt yourself. But we cruised down the mountain, no problems. And when we got to the bottom, we had huge smiles on our faces. The wind had been blowing through our helmets and the endorphins running through our bodies. And we started heading back to Denver. And at this point, we got onto 32nd Avenue and headed east because that was the straightest shot back to town. And I decided that Matt could lead because I figured, A, he wouldn't get lost, and B, he probably wanted to feel like he was better than a female cyclist. So I let him get in the lead, and so we're riding back, and I'm behind him. And as I was riding, I started to get lost in my thoughts and my daydreams about that time when I was going to be, you know, one of those pro cyclists, and I would be the one to cross the finish line first, and I would raise my arms up in victory, and I could even feel the weight of that heavy gold medal as it hung around my neck as I stood atop the podium. But then I looked up, and I saw in front of me that Matt was crossing a street called Crabapple. And I didn't think much of Crabapple Street until I saw that there was a car headed westbound, getting into its left-hand lane, and turning and also entering Crabapple Street. And I watched as Matt had to make a big swerving motion to get around that car. And I thought, surely that driver sees that they almost hit a cyclist. But then in that moment, I realized that the driver didn't see anything. And so I went for the brakes on my bike, and I didn't get to them quickly enough. And the front wheel of my bike hit the front bumper of the car. I was launched into midair, landing on my back and falling to the ground. And as I hit the ground, my body felt disconnected, because I could feel the warm pavement under my shoulders, but I couldn't feel anything under my legs. They felt like they were floating in midair. And as I tried to get my knees to bend, my quads to tighten, my ankles to roll, nothing happened. The date was September 17th, 2000, and right there at the corner of 32nd and Crabapple Street, my life hit a crossroads and everything changed. So, of course, a commotion broke out above me. I could hear people coming out of their homes, and cars were driving up next to me, and they were stopping, and car doors opening, closing, and I could hear footsteps coming close to me. And then in the next instant, I heard Matt getting on his phone and calling 911. And so it seemed like forever, it was probably minutes, before the emergency crews came. And there was the fire truck, the ambulance, the police. And an EMT, two EMTs actually came over and knelt down next to me, and they started asking questions about the bike ride that I was on, about how long it was and where we were going, what happened in the accident, where I was hurting. And eventually they pulled out a neck brace, they slid it up my chest and fastened it around my neck, slid me onto a backboard, and that backboard onto a gurney, and the gurney into the ambulance. And the ambulance took me to St. Anthony Central Hospital. And as I was pushed into the emergency room, I was swarmed by nurses and doctors and people barking medical terms and conditions, many of which I didn't understand. And finally, a nurse pushed me into my very own curtained-off cubicle, and she started getting me ready for the night of tests ahead. And to do that, she had to cut off my Lycra cycling outfit. And so she slid a pair of metal shears up the leg of my cycling shorts, and I knew that I should feel that cold metal against my skin, but I felt nothing. And so that night, I went through a whole battery of tests, CAT scan, x-rays, MRI, and at the end of the night, the doctors were able to give my family my prognosis. Now think of the worst blow that you could get. For me, as a cyclist, it was this. that I had suffered a chest-level spinal cord injury and that I would never walk again. Now think of that word, never. I had an English teacher who once taught, never write the word never because it sounds so permanent, so serious, so final. And so that was the night that, even though I was still alive, that I believed that my life was over. And I actually stopped believing that I was capable of doing anything. So I spent 3.5 weeks in St. Anthony Hospital, basically being put back together again. I had 5 broken vertebrae, 2 broken ribs, and a broken scapula, and a cracked vertebrae in my neck. And so I stayed there for those 3.5 weeks and got stabilized. And then one day my nurse, Debbie, came in and she said, Trish, we've done all we can do for you here, and it's time for you to go to Craig Rehabilitation Hospital, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with. And so they put me into an ambulance and took me across town to this rehabilitation hospital for people with traumatic brain injuries and spinal cord injuries. And when I got there, I wondered, what does rehabilitation really mean? Because they had already told me I was never going to walk again. But I was met by a whole team of specialists. I had a doctor and a nurse and a variety of therapists, and they were there to help me get my life back. And it's what I now refer to as Life 101, because there were a lot of steps, a lot of things that I had to learn. And at the time, they didn't seem like small tasks. They seemed like monumental lessons for me to learn. So I was admitted to the hospital, and I was going to be working with a bunch of therapists while I was there. And so every day was like high school. It was like going to one class at a time. And so I would have physical therapy and occupational therapy and rec therapy. And so the first therapist that I worked with was a woman named Stacy, and she was a physical therapist. And she was about my age. She had long, dark hair. She was very enthusiastic. And she came to pick me up in my room for my first day of physical therapy. And so she helped me get into my wheelchair from the bed and pushed me down to the therapy gym. And she said, okay, Trish, my job is to teach you how to learn how to do transfers, which means to get from my chair to another seat where I want to be sitting, whether it's the shower bench or the car or the bed. But she said, the first thing that you have to learn is how to sit up. And so she got me close to this therapy mat, which was about the height of my chair and maybe 10 feet by 10 feet. And she scooted me over onto this mat and laid me down on my back. And she said, now we have to start with first things first. Before you start transfers, you have to learn how to sit up. And I thought to myself, well, that's so simple. I mean, if you think about it, what was the first thing that you did this morning when your alarm went off? If you're like me, you hit the snooze. But after that, you sat up, right? So I was doing what I always did, and I tightened my stomach muscles, and I sent that signal from my brain to my body that says sit up. And nothing happened. I had no idea that when you're paralyzed from the chest down, you can't just sit up. Your stomach muscles, your core, they don't engage, and you can't arrive at a sitting position. And so I looked up at Stacy, and my face got flushed, and my eyes filled with tears. And I said, Stacy, what am I going to do with my life if I can't do the most basic thing that everybody does first thing every morning? And she said, Trish, I'll give you this. You have a long way to go. But she said, just because you're in a wheelchair doesn't mean that your life is over. She said, you will still be able to do all the same things you've always done. You're just going to have to learn a new way to do them. And I didn't really believe her at first until she taught me how to roll over on my side and push up on my elbow and push up on my hand and arrive at a seating position. And I realized that day that she had taught me a very valuable lesson that I think is important for all of us to know. And that is, there's always more than one way to do something. There's always more than one way to achieve a goal. And sometimes, we get so frustrated and we throw our arms up in the air and we say, I can't do this, or there's only one way to do it. There's no other way to do it. But the thing is if you're willing to be flexible and to be creative, there is always more than one way to achieve a goal. So after I worked with that therapist for a while, I started realizing that this was really a team prospect. I mean, I had a long way to go, and there was no way that I could do it alone. And it reinforced for me, you know, kind of what I had learned my entire life of being an athlete. You know, I was on the swim team, the gymnastics team, the diving team, and I realized that not, you know, just one of us could win alone. We had to rely on each other's strengths. And I had to rely on these therapists and their strengths because this wasn't something that I could do by myself. And so another therapist that I worked with was a woman named Ina, and she was an occupational therapist. And her job was to help me get back to my activities of daily living. And the thing I liked best about Ina was that she was the same height standing up as I was sitting down. So we could usually see eye to eye. But there was one day that she came to my room and she said, "Trish, I'm going to take you down to the kitchen because I have to make sure that you can get around and still cook a meal." And I looked at Ina and I said, "Ina, you just said the word still," which would imply that I was cooking before my accident. And I said, "Obviously, you don't know who I am." And I said, I decided to use Stacy's logic. And I said, "If you can find me a phone book and a phone, I can show you a new way to do the same thing. Because there's always more than one way to achieve a goal." But so I went through, you know, my months at Craig, and I was learning things every single day. And but there was one other therapist that I worked with, and she was so important to my recovery because she believed that life was about much more than being able to get up and get dressed every day and get around the kitchen. She said, "Life is about the things that make you the person that you are." And so her name was Claire. She was a very tall and lean athletic woman. And when she came to my room the first time, she said, "My job is to make sure that you get the fun back into your life." And I thought, well, what's fun about being in a wheelchair? And she said, "Here's the thing. We can do anything you want. We can go scuba diving. We can go golfing. We can play tennis. We can go water skiing. We can go swimming. We can go biking." And of course, she had me at biking. And I said, "Absolutely, I want to be on a bike." And so she took me down to the rec therapy room, and she showed me this special three-wheeled vehicle called a hand cycle. And she asked me if I wanted to give it a try. So I looked at it. It looked very similar to my bike. It had a chain and gears and brakes and two pedals that I could use, but they were for my hands instead of my feet. And I said, "Absolutely, let's give it a shot." So she and another therapist lifted me and got me down into this hand cycle, which is very low to the ground. And then she walked over across the room and got in a hand cycle of her own. And we literally rode out of the rec therapy room, down the hallway, through the sliding glass doors, out into the parking lot and the street. And that day, Claire wanted to take me on about a 3-mile ride through the neighborhood surrounding Craig Hospital just to get a feel for the bike. And so we were riding around, and since she was used to doing this with her patients all the time, she was very strong, even though she wasn't in a wheelchair, but her arms were super strong. And so she was riding way in front of me, and I was doing everything I could to keep up with her. And as a competitive individual, to be left in the dust like that, it was awful. And so I kept riding and kept riding, and finally we did the whole loop and we got back to the hospital, and Claire jumped out of her bike and she said, "How did you like that? That was awesome, wasn't it?" And I looked at her and I said, "Claire, how am I ever going to do this? Because I'm used to riding 70 and 80 and 90 miles at a time. How am I ever going to get any satisfaction out of 3 miles? How am I going to learn this?" And she said, "You're going to do it the same way that you do anything that's new. You're going to work hard, do a little more every day, stay patient, and don't give up." And so I let those words kind of marinate in my head, and I headed back to my room. And, you know, it wasn't but a few days later when she was back asking me, you know, if I wanted to do a little bit more rec therapy. And I said, "Sure, you know, let's go ride the hand cycle." And she said, "Well, you know, I actually have something a little bit different for you. I want to take you to see this piece of equipment called a racing chair." And she explained to me that a racing chair was what you use for like a marathon, like Boston Marathon, or even a 10K, the Boulder. And she said, "I think you're going to really enjoy it." And so she shows me this chair, and at first I couldn't figure out how my body was even going to fit into it. But as it turned out, I got all scrunched up into this little seat, and she gave me these big black gloves that I put on my hands, And she showed me how to punch on the push rims to make them go forward. You don't hold them like regular ones, you just punch them. And we took the chair to Wash Park, which has an interior loop of just under 2 miles. And so, you know, I would do a few push strokes, and then she'd have to push me a little, and then I'd do a few more, and she'd push me a little more. And it was very difficult because there's a lot of technique that's involved, and at that time, I definitely didn't have it. And so at the end, when we had made a one whole loop around Wash Park, again, she got all excited, and she said, you know, what do you think? How do you like it? And I said, Claire, I will never do a 26.2 mile marathon in this chair. And in fact, I was thinking to myself, that was the most work for the least return I have ever experienced in my entire life. But Claire had her same speech. You're going to work hard, do a little more every day, stay patient, and don't give up. Well, that was starting to like drill its way into my head. And I was working every day toward getting out of Craig. And eventually, my nearly 4 month stay was about to be up. And so as we were preparing for my discharge, one of the last things that Claire said she wanted to do with me was to make sure that I could still swim, because she said, you have been a swimmer your entire life. That is one thing that you know that you are from the core. She said, you know, let's go down to the pool that's on the first floor of Craig, and I want to make sure that you feel comfortable in the water. And so on my last day of rec therapy, we went down there, and she helped me transfer over into the lift, and this lift rotated me down into the water. And she walked down the stairs and met me, and she grabbed me so that I, you know, wouldn't drown just then. And I said, you know, I'm pretty confident about this, you. I have been swimming since I was 4, and I'm actually a really good swimmer. And so just, you know, put me on my stomach, and I will swim circles around you. And she did. And I took one stroke, and I didn't take one more. I sunk straight to the bottom of the pool. I had no idea how my body had become dead weight and how my legs would spasm in the water and I wouldn't be able to keep myself afloat. And I was very fortunate because Claire's really good at her job. She was actually paying very close attention, and she realized I wasn't coming back up again. So she pulls me up to the top of the water, and I said, you know, that had to have been a fluke because I am a really good swimmer. I've done a lot of pulling sets where I haven't used my legs, you know, to kick. I can do this. So she's like, sure, you know, puts me back on my stomach, take another stroke, again, sunk straight to the bottom of the pool. So this time when I came up and I said, you know what? I don't want to hear about working hard. I don't want to do a little more every day. I don't want to stay patient. I give up. I said, swimming is just one of those things I'm not going to be able to do anymore since I've had this accident. And so that was the last lesson that I had at Craig. And it was time for me to be discharged. And I wasn't going to be able to go back home again because my house was full of narrow doorways and stairs, and there just was no way. And so my family helped me find a first floor condominium where I was going to go live by myself. And I was discharged on a blizzarding Colorado day. It wasn't the same month I went into the hospital. It wasn't even the same year. I was discharged January 26th, 2001. And when I went home, my brothers were nice enough to, you know, bring my boxes of things and unpack and help me get settled, but I was living by myself. So once they left, there I was, all alone, and it was so quiet. There were no more nurses and doctors coming in to check on me, no more poker games with the other patients in the rec room at night, no call light so that I could push to get a glass of water when I was thirsty. I was there alone. And you know how when you're by yourself and you might be feeling a little down or depressed, and there's this demon that sits on your shoulders and whispers all of these really mean things in your ear, like, this isn't what you expected for your life. You're paralyzed now. You're never going to be happy. You can't do the things you used to do. And that demon was sitting square on my shoulder and yelling those things in my ears. And I would try to go out into the community back and try to reintegrate into my life. But, you know, every time I went someplace, people were staring me up and down because I now carried this new label, disabled. And if you look disabled up in the dictionary, it says things like broken, crippled, damaged. And I wondered if that's what people really thought about me. But when I went home and I looked at myself in the mirror and I saw these legs that used to power a bicycle sitting lifeless in my chair, and I started to believe that. I started to believe I was less and that I wasn't able. And it took a long time for me to go through the stages of grief and figure out, you know, how am I going to live with this new condition? But then I remembered something that my doctor had told me when I was in the hospital. She said, "You will have an easier time dealing with this injury because of the fact that you're an athlete." And I didn't realize at first what that meant until I realized that being in a wheelchair is kind of like a sport. It's not the kind of sport you choose for yourself. It's not swimming or gymnastics or diving. But it takes the same physical awareness and mental toughness that I had been training for my entire life. And so when I started to reframe how I looked at it, and instead of looking at my wheelchair as something that was going to confine me or define me, and I looked at it as something that would set me free, then I started to have a completely different attitude. It's how we reframe the things that get in our way that cause us to stumble. And if you can reframe it into a positive aspect, then you can move forward so much quicker than if you continue to look at the negative. And so one of the first things that I did was I got on the phone and I called Claire back at the hospital and I said, "Claire, I'm ready to learn to swim." And she invited me back to the pool and we tried another time. Only this time she said, "I'm going to be in control this time. I'm going to tell you what to do because it didn't work very well the other way last time." And so she gets me in the water and she puts me on my back, just like my very first swim instructor did when I was 4 years old. And she pulled me around through the pool in the back float so I could feel what my body did in the water and, you know, how I needed to balance a little bit differently. And then I started taking a stroke. And I took one stroke and the next. And by the end of this lesson, I was able to do the backstroke all the way across the pool. Of course, the pool was only from about that wall to where I am. But I figured if I worked hard, did a little more every day, stayed patient, and didn't give up, I would be able to swim just as far as I wanted to. So when I got home, I started feeling a lot more optimistic. And by that time, I'd really gotten back to my life. I purchased a car with hand controls, and I went back to my full-time job at the school, and I was hanging out with my friends and doing the things I liked to do when I was exercising on my hand cycle and on my racing chair. But there was one thing that was missing, and for me as a competitive athlete, well, it was competition. And I'd learned about a lot of different sports when I was in the hospital. I mean, there's competitive basketball, and like I said, I could push the racing chair in a marathon. But I decided to do something that I wasn't really seeing anybody do. I wanted to do the sport they call the triathlon, the swim, bike, and run. And because we have a lot of them here in Colorado, I looked around at some of the different races, and I found one in Fort Collins that was a sprint, which is the shortest distance. And so I decided to call up the race director and see if it was possible to do his race. And so I call him up and I introduced him and I said, "You know, my name is Trish Downing and I'm in a wheelchair and I would like to do your triathlon." And of course the other line was silent because he had no idea what to make of somebody who used a wheelchair who wanted to do a triathlon. And so I started to explain to him what I've explained to you about my sports and the swimming and the biking and the running and the fact that I'd been practicing enough that I was fairly certain I wasn't going to drown in the swim. And he said, "You know, I have no idea how to help you, but you are more than welcome to come up to my race if you bring people to support you." And so I grabbed my support crew because, you know, big undertakings cannot be done alone. I got my five best friends, and we headed up to Fort Collins just a couple of weeks later. And as we got there, I was leading the way, and I pushed into the pool area. It was an indoor pool, and I was looking around, and all I could see in front of me were all these tan and fit bodies. And I was starting to think, "Oh, I don't know if I should be here." But you know, I was comparing myself to people who had a completely different life, a completely different physical capability than I had. And my friends encouraged me to stay and to at least try to do the race. And so the race that day was a 450-yard swim. And it was going to be done in snake swim style, which means you go up one lane and down the next and up the next and down the next all the way across the pool. And it was time trial format, so there was 5 seconds between each swimmer. So I watched as each swimmer dove into the water and started swimming freestyle. And, you know, it was the line. We were lined up around the pool, kind of like in a snake formation. And I was the end of the snake because, of course, I was the slowest. But as I looked up into the bleachers behind me, I felt more like, you know, the butt of the joke because, you know, should I be there? I just still wasn't sure. But as each swimmer went into the water and I got closer and closer to the time, my friends lifted me out of my chair and they put me down, you know, at the edge of the pool. And, you know, sometimes you just want to like kind of dip a toe in the water when you're trying something new to see like what the possibilities are. No, my friends shoved me into the water. So I had no choice but to swim. And so I rolled over on my back and I started swimming the backstroke that I'd learned at Craig. And I did the snake swim up and down all the lanes. And when I finally got to the end, I was so excited because I had finished the race that I looked up into the bleachers because I wanted to see all the smiling faces. And I was wondering if maybe I'd get a standing ovation, but the bleachers were empty. And I looked all across the pool deck, empty, except for the 5 friends that I brought to help me. And they pulled me out of the water and they got me into my wheelchair and they pushed me outside into transition, which is where you change from the swim to the bike and the bike to the run. And transition is full of bike racks where everybody racks their bike. But at this time, there were no bikes there. All the racks were empty because everyone was still out on the bike course. And so I get into my bike and I start riding out and my arms felt like noodles. And I get out onto the course. And what was really cool about the course that day was that it was 12 miles, but it was actually 3 laps. So 3 laps of 4 miles. So when I got out there, all the other racers were still there. And they were cheering for me. They were saying things like, go, Wheels, you can do this. You know, they were really starting to warm up to my presence. And so I'm riding along with them, and I'm having a great time on the first lap. And then on the second lap, there were fewer cyclists out there. And the ones that were, they had their helmets on backwards, and they were riding these huffy mountain bikes. And they were blowing by me, and I was thinking, I'm getting beat by a bunch of rookies. And then on the last lap, I was out there all by myself. And as I'm riding along, that demon came back to haunt me. And he was sitting on my shoulder and he said, you know what? Girls in wheelchairs don't do triathlons. You'll never be able to keep up with these people. They're faster than you and they can use their legs. And I listened to that demon for the longest time. And then I remember this bike race that I had done before my accident. And I had had a very bad day. I didn't eat well. I bonked in the middle of the race. And I watched the whole field just ride away from me. And I was all by myself, just riding to get to the finish line. And there was a woman from one of the other categories who rode up next to me. And she said, hey, how you doing? She's trying to make some small talk in the middle of this race. And I said, you know, I suck. And she said, you can't define yourself as an athlete by just one race. Just like you can't define yourself as a person by just one meeting at work or by one exam at school or, heaven forbid, by one very bad first date. And she said, you know, your body can only do what your body can do on any given day. And so she told me that I needed to ride my own race. So I started thinking, I'm like, that kind of makes sense. And I got into transition and, of course, all the bike racks were empty again. It wasn't because anybody was on the bike. It was because they were all done with the entire race. They were at home with their feet up having a sandwich. And I'm just about to begin the running leg of the race. And so I get in my racing chair and I start pushing along. And I was just looking down at the ground and counting the cracks and naming the ants and feeling sorry for myself because I was in last place all by myself. And then I thought, no, remember? You have to ride your own race. So I decided to say that to myself in my mind, and I thought, ride my own race. ride my own race, ride my own. And then I looked up and I saw in front of me a healthy, albeit tired, able-bodied runner. And I thought, dude, you're going down. And so I started pushing harder and harder. And I ended up passing that guy. And I was so excited because I wasn't last anymore. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is awesome. So I pushed as hard as I could for the rest of the race. And I passed another runner and another runner and another runner. And by the time I was finished, I had passed 7 runners in total. And when I crossed the finish lines, I threw my arms up in victory. And it wasn't because I got first place or 10th place or 40th place, but it was because I realized I was an athlete. And when they put the finisher's medal around my neck that day, I realized how many people's perceptions I had changed, because the race director went from speechless to surprised. And the other racers in the morning, they were looking at my disability. And by the end of the day, they could see my ability. And I even realized for myself, I changed my own perception about what I was capable of, because I realized that when you get out of your comfort zone, but you stay the course, that's when you find within you this inner champion that is capable of anything you put your mind to. And it was then that I began again to believe. Oh my goodness, yes. You gotta stay the course even when you get out of your comfort zone. So anyway, you know, I love to do triathlons, and I'll tell you why I like to do them is because, you know, every time I cross the finish line, I surprise myself. It could be that I was faster than I was last time, or maybe I felt superhuman strong, or maybe it could just be that I was happy for the things that I could do, and I wasn't worrying about the things that I can't do. And I also realized that it doesn't matter who you are or where you come from. We are all in a race. You might not be in the swimming, biking, or running race, but we're all in our human race. And your human race is where you decide who you are, what you want to be, and how you're going to go about doing it. And so I want to leave you today with just a couple of pointers just to wind up what I had been talking about. And one of those is, when you get into difficult situations, are you going to be the victim or the warrior? And the victim is the person who says, when things don't work out, I'll find another way. There's more than one way to achieve a goal. I mean, the victim is not like that. The victim is the person who feels sorry for themselves and who is not going to make any, you know, changes to be any other way. But the warrior is the person who says, there's always more than one way to achieve a goal. And then reframing your situation. Again, as I did with my wheelchair, at first it was something that felt confining and defining. But I realized that I could look at it in a different way. You might see my wheelchair as a wheelchair, but I see it as a sport. I see it as something to challenge me and to that I can conquer, and something that can make my life more fulfilled if I, you know, if I embrace it how I want to. So, getting out of your comfort zone. Let me tell you, when I was in that sprint triathlon, I was 100% out of my comfort zone. But I stayed the course. I kept on going even when I knew I was last place or I wasn't doing well or I couldn't compete with people who were using their legs. But I found that when I stayed and I stayed in my, you know, out of my comfort zone, but I stayed the course, then I was able to become, in my mind and in my assessment, a champion. And then lastly, I just want to share one more thing. I think it's really important to believe in hope. And I know a lot of times people say that, you know, hope is not a strategy or, you know, there's no such thing as hope getting you to your end goals. But I feel like you can't get anywhere without it. And when I've looked at experts who study hope, there are three kind of basic things that is involved in hope. And number one is that you believe that your situation can get better. And number two is that you feel that you have the ability to make it so. And number three, that you know there are a variety of ways that you can get to that end goal, and you might have to try them all, everything from A to Z. And so I think the important thing to remember is that, you know, when you give up hope, you have decided, I have no control over this situation. I'm not even going to try. End of story. But if you do believe in hope, then you will say, things can get better. They may take time. I have the ability, and I'll find a way. Thank you very much. So as I shared with you at the beginning of my presentation, my personal motto is always believe you can. And so these cards coming around are so you can create your own personal motto and keep it in your purse, your wallet, at your desk, on the refrigerator, wherever you want.
Wow. Thank you, Tricia.
Sure.
Aren't you glad you came today? Very exciting to hear just your story and to glean from your story how that affects every human being in the race. So you're happy to take a few questions? Does anybody have any questions? Debbie? I'm going to let you speak in the microphone.
Tricia, thank you so much for being here.
You're
wow.
Welcome.
You are so articulate. You're such a great speaker, and your message is so important. I've read about you for a long time, and I've been so anxious to have the chance to hear you speak, and so I'm so grateful. Would you mind sharing a little bit about those camps that you do that I've read about?
Sure. I actually am no longer doing them, but I started a camp called Camp Discovery for female wheelchair, for females who are wheelchair users. And we did sports and fitness, and I started a nonprofit, and we did that for 10 years. But I don't do it anymore. It was awesome.
Anybody else?
Hello. Just want to say, just listening to you changed my mind about so many things already, and you're just awesome, and thank you so much. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Trisha's books are back here, Chance for Rain and Cycle of Hope, if you are interested. Do you want to tell us just a little bit about each book, which one came first, and what was your goal in writing it?
Sure. Yeah, my first book is The Cycle of Hope, the one on the right-hand side that's yellow. That is a memoir, and it's the expanded-on version of what I've told you today about my journey through this injury, and I wrote that in 2010. And Chance for Rain is actually a fiction novel. My goal as a writer is to bring characters with disabilities into mainstream fiction. So my character in this particular book is also a wheelchair user, and she is looking for love. My new book that will be out in 2022, I'm hoping, my main character is blind. So just trying to introduce more characters with disabilities so that we see ourselves in the media and on TV and in film and books.
Thank you, Trish, for telling mm-hmm. your story. So Trish has a lot of influence on myself as a paraplegic, in the fact that I read The Cycle of Hope just as I got out of Craig Hospital. And as I was reading her book, you know, it was my life too at the time. The whole Craig is pretty similar, as she was at Craig too as a paraplegic after tragic accidents. And we don't know where our life is going to be after a paralysis and after an accident. But after reading your book, Trish, it put a whole perspective in my life. And you have helped me to know that, follow your dreams, have that hope. And after reading, and you were swimming, which I love to swim, and biking, which I've learned to bike, and I love. I'm not going to do a triathlon, or maybe I will, but you have helped me to know what my life and how I'm very active. I'm an athlete, but not a competitive athlete. But reading that has definitely brought me to where I am 5 years after my accident. So thank you, too.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Alrighty. Well, you can hang out here by the book table, and if you don't need to run out, as you can see, we're trying to encourage the development of our caring community by having these fun little conversation starters, which you can enjoy with somebody either at the beginning or at the end of our presentations. But feel free to hang around, visit, peruse the books, and grab a clementine and some coffee before you head out. And put January 11th on your new 2022 calendar. See you next year.